Today on Against the Grain, a groundbreaking study conducted over 8 decades has shed light on what makes some of us live longer than others from the same socioeconomic background, and many of the results are quite surprising. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with one of the scientists involved in the Longevity Project. That's coming right up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The conventional wisdom of why some people live longer than others from the same relatively affluent socioeconomic background runs along these lines. Happy and optimistic people are long-lived, while worriers and those who put their noses to the grindstone and work long hours tend to have shortened lifespans. And various epidemiological studies have bolstered those conclusions. Yet what if those studies tend to be inherently flawed, and that the social and personal character traits associated with longevity are quite different, even the opposite? Those claims are based on a groundbreaking study which managed to follow a group of 1,500 Americans born in 1910 over the course of their entire lives. It was initiated by Stanford University professor Lewis Terman, who died during the course of the study, but it was continued by others who've used the data to analyze the impacts of social connections, personality, religious involvement, gender, marriage, and stress, among other factors, on living long. I spoke with one of the researchers involved in the study, Leslie Martin, professor of psychology at La Sierra University and research psychologist at UC Riverside. She's the co-author, with Howard S. Friedman, of the Longevity Project, Surprising Discoveries for Health and Long Life from the landmark 8-decade study. I asked her how Dr. Terman's study began in the 1920s.
Yes, so Terman was interested in studying smart kids. He wanted to see if he could identify early in their lives some indicators that would speak to whether they were going to be great or not. And he also was interested in demonstrating that they grew up to be normal, productive people, because there was a contingent at the time that really believed being too smart was not a good thing, that you would be sort of eggheadish and sickly and really not so well-adjusted. And Terman didn't believe that. So he recruited 1,528 kids from mostly San Francisco and Los Angeles areas of California, and IQ tested them, and if they met the criterion, which was 135 IQ, they were invited, or their parents were invited, to have them be part of the study. And Lewis Terman followed them until they reached adulthood and indeed found that they adjusted well and did fine and were normal. But he was having, a good deal of fun, perhaps, with the study. He was finding a lot of interesting things and publishing some volumes, and so decided to continue the study and did that until he died in 1956. And then others picked up the study. So the data collection continued at 5 to 10 year intervals throughout the participants' entire lives. And as they grew up and had kids and had their careers, and some of them got divorced, and just all of the nuances of their lives were documented. Then in 1991, we recognized that this was an incredibly rich, very unique data set, and decided that we would spend, we thought, a couple of years looking at health outcomes, and in particular longevity, and collecting death certificates. So we began that project, and 20 years later, we're starting to tie it up.
So you mentioned the locations where the people in the study came from, but how about other information? Were they from a particular class or range of classes or races?
Terman didn't make any particular effort to be inclusive. He went into a lot of classrooms, but given the schools he was going into, it is almost an entirely white sample. It's about 99% white. The kids were mostly middle class, so it's not a diverse sample, and certainly they're all quite smart. So in some ways, not representative. At the same time, this enables us to eliminate some of the typical sorts of explanations. So So, for example, we know when we find, you know, health problems or early mortality that it's not an issue of not having proper nutrition or inadequate access to medical care, those kinds of things. Of course, by the same token, it means that we have to be quite careful and look at other studies that do that are more inclusive and have, you know, various ethnic groups and things like that included, and make sure that what we're finding from this longitudinal study in fact matches with and complements what is being found in other studies.
And how unusual is a study like this that follows people across the expanse of their lives?
It's incredibly rare. I mean, there actually is no other study quite like this one that has followed people in as much detail as it has over the time that they were basically 10 years old was the average when they were recruited until they died. So it's very unique. It's also wonderful in terms of diversity that there are almost half of the sample is girls and women, which in the early 1920s, I mean, nobody looked at girls and women, so I do feel very fortunate that we have a pretty equal distribution of the sexes.
So what would be, or what is, superior about this kind of long-term study that, as you say, followed people over the course of their lives in comparison to other studies that are done on what factors might contribute to someone living a long time or dying young?
Right. That's a great question. A lot of the studies that look at longevity really do start quite late in life, sometimes selecting from people who are already octogenarians or, you know, they've made it to 100 or something like that. And that's an interesting thing to look at. But what it fails to take into account is all of the people who might have had similar goals or similar diets or similar whatevers and didn't make it to that age. So this study is a prospective study where children were followed and data were gathered without knowing what the ultimate outcome would be. So that removes a big piece of bias. We are able to then go back and look at the factors that predispose individuals to particular outcomes or that are good predictors of outcomes. And a longitudinal prospective design like this really is the gold standard. It's what we all would love to do. But the thing is, it takes a long time. And so, you know, if we had wanted to start such a study ourselves, we wouldn't have been able to know the results. We would have been dead before the study was done. And so that's why we're so fortunate and so indebted to Terman and all of the participants that we can go back and mine through these data and answer a lot of the questions that we have without having to start from the beginning.
So at the beginning of the program, I mentioned a number of the things that are presumed about longevity and lifestyle related to marriage and happiness and so on. What was the thing that, more than anything else, tied together those who lived a long time?
Well, the thing that was the strongest personality predictor, which isn't really, I think, the most surprising one, but that was conscientiousness. So we found, and this was very consistent, and it was true when we looked from childhood going forward and when we looked in adulthood going forward, that those who were more conscientious, they were prudent and responsible and organized and honest and hardworking. They started things and then stuck with those things and pursued their goals. That was really fundamental, and individuals with those qualities really did live longer than their peers who were less so.
And how do you define living longer? Is this a year or two, substantially longer?
We're talking about 4 years, so 3.5 to 4 years. So it really is a pretty big difference. It's not a matter of a few weeks or even a few months. And some of this effect was through pathways that you would expect. So we saw that the individuals who were higher on conscientiousness were less likely to be smokers. They were less likely to be the heavy drinkers and contain many more of the complete abstainers as well. They tended not to have risky hobbies. And so some of those direct behavioral mechanisms we saw playing a role. But it really went beyond that. We also saw that the more conscientious folks tended to gravitate into sort of stable, steady, rewarding life paths. They were more likely to be steadily married. They were more likely to be consistently in a career and sort of move up through the ranks and pursue that and find meaning in that, as opposed to jumping around from job to job and feeling like they hadn't really found their life's work yet. So those were interesting things that do make sense in retrospect, but weren't necessarily things that we would have predicted.
And when you speak of conscientiousness, do you weight more or less conscientiousness in someone's personal life versus their professional life? There are people who might be very organized and conscientious at work, but perhaps not at home, or vice versa.
Yeah, so really when we think of the personality traits, we think of it sort of aggregated across all domains. And so many of the questions will talk about, you know, to what degree or with what amount of vigor do you pursue your goals? But whether those are occupational goals or personal goals is not really specified. So the construct itself is conceptualized as a broad thing that should extend to all areas of life, although you're absolutely right. I mean, we are more or less so, and everybody's different in different areas of life.
Another thing you flag is conscientiousness in childhood and then conscientiousness in adulthood, because clearly there are some people who might have started out as very conscientious and became less so with age, or the opposite. And how do you weigh those? And what's the significance of being a conscientious child?
Yeah, so that was really interesting, and we were interested in the change that could potentially happen. There's a fair amount of consistency in people's personalities over time, but particularly as you're still growing and developing in childhood, you know, there is room for change. And so we looked at that, and we saw that the best case scenario was being conscientious from the beginning. You're high in that dimension as a kid, and you remain that way into adulthood. If you were a non-conscientious kid or someone low on that, and you became more conscientious as you moved into adulthood, that increased your likely longevity. Your mortality risk was commensurately decreased. And by the same token, if you started out conscientious and you sort of let that go and somehow changed to be less conscientious over time, you were at additional risk. The worst case scenario was being low at both time points. I think it's also interesting that these really were independent. And so controlling for one, it's not that adulthood was just a proxy for childhood or vice versa. They really were independent predictors. And even though they're both part of the same dimension, when you think of a broad personality dimension like conscientiousness, it's made of a lot of different things. You know, it is organization and responsibility and honesty and all of these different things. And the measurements that were taken in childhood were somewhat different than those in adulthood. And they were tapping into, to some degree, different aspects of being conscientious. And they were collected from parents and teachers, so the kids weren't rating themselves in childhood. Whereas in adulthood, it was self-ratings and tied in more closely to certain facets that had been more loosely addressed in childhood.
The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and my guest is Leslie Martin. She's the co-author of The Longevity Project, published by Hudson Street Press, and she teaches psychology at La Sierra University in Riverside. So the stereotype is that people who live a long time are those who are kind of happy-go-lucky. It's certainly the opposite of one's notion of conscientiousness. Someone who's conscientious would be a little more worried about having everything in order. What about that stereotype of the happy-go-lucky, sociable person? Why is that not tied to longevity?
Yeah, and you asked earlier about what was the most surprising, and I think to me this was perhaps the most surprising thing, because there are a lot of studies that have pointed to the positive health benefits associated with optimism and cheerfulness. And we found that these more happy-go-lucky, good sense of humor, optimistic, cheerful kids actually lived shorter lives than their less cheerful, optimistic peers. And that, to me, just flew in the face of everything that I had expected. But again, we have to look at, you know, what kind of data are we using? And most of the studies out there that show these positive benefits deal with people who are facing a crisis of some sort. So many of the studies have been done on people recovering from surgery or people who are, you know, facing some other sort of obstacle in their lives. And what seems very clear is that when you are facing hardship, it is good to be optimistic. If you don't believe that things can get better and that eventually it will all be okay, it's much more difficult to stay engaged in the process of doing whatever needs to be done in order to get you out of that situation. But as a life approach, when every single day, every decision you encounter, every scenario that you come up against, if you're immediate reaction is, oh, it will be fine, you know, nothing bad will happen, it's all going to be working out just great. That seems to change the way you evaluate risk and the way you make decisions about what you will do. And so we saw, just as we had seen the more conscientious kids living certain kinds of lives, we saw these cheerful, optimistic kids being much more likely to smoke. They were likely to be the heavier drinkers. They had the riskier hobbies. And so you see, again, this sort of trajectory that begins with an attitude but plays itself out in some very real ways that cumulatively add up to a substantial risk.
But are these traits, do they tend to be associated with the kinds of lifestyles that people choose to follow, or do you think there's something else? What role does genetics or biology play in all of this? Obviously, science seems to switch back and forth between emphasizing the social context or familial context in which someone grows up and the kind of lifestyle they live, and then their biology, and things seem to have swung back towards the biology side. So what about that aspect of all this? And is that something that this study even was able to take into account in any way?
Well, so the genetic aspect, and this really is that age-old nature-nurture question, genetics seem to account for about a third of the variability in how long people live, at least when you're looking at sort of normal range lives. When you move up into, you know, people who are making it past 100, it seems that genetics actually do play a bigger role. There's some very specific special stuff going on there. But when we're looking at normal lifespans up through the late 80s and early 90s, it seems like it's about a third that's attributable to genetics. But what that means is that we've got about two-thirds left that's personality and psychosocial kinds of factors that are left to be at least somewhat determined by the individual and by the context in which he or she finds herself or himself. Our data set did not allow us to look at genetic factors. Despite the fact that some of the volumes are called the genetic studies of genius, we don't have genetic data. There were some physical measurements and things that were taken at the very first assessment in childhood, but that's one of the things that I really do wish we had in this incredible data set was better biological, physiological data, because that's a piece that we haven't been able to look at in much detail. In some cases, particularly working back from the death certificates, knowing what people died from, and the self-reports of what sorts of illnesses and injuries they had, we can piece together some parts, but really, in terms of genetics, we don't know.
So you make a statement in the book that healthy people tend to be happy, but happy people are not necessarily healthy. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so I think our general tendency is to buy into this notion that if you are happy, that will promote your health. And this sort of links back to that optimism, cheerfulness idea, but it's not quite the same thing. What we do see, though, is that on average, I mean, there is a correlation between health and happiness. People who are happy oftentimes are healthy, and the reverse. But it's not that the happiness is causing the health. What we see instead is that there are these third factors. So many of the things that people do and experience and engage in that promote happiness also tend to promote health. And so we see these two characteristics, health and happiness, oftentimes going together, but the causal arrows really are not there in the way that we typically think of it. So to recommend that, oh, you know, you need to put on a happy face, you need to, you know, watch some things that make you laugh every day on the television, and that's really going to help your health, is not good advice, because there's not good evidence for that.
Well, going to the other extreme, you're arguing that conscientiousness tends to be the defining individual characteristic that is associated with longevity. What about people who tend toward catastrophic thinking? So I don't know if that would be defined as extreme conscientiousness, you know, verging into the apocalyptic, but what about people who have that kind of personality trait that perhaps would also prevent them from doing certain risky behaviors because they always expect the worst outcome?
Yeah. I would argue certainly that, that this catastrophic thinking that we were able to look at in the longevity project is not the same thing as conscientiousness. We're looking here at a dimension that, that we refer to as explanatory style. So basically, when things happen, how do you explain those events? What do you see as being the causal factors? And so there are three dimensions, internal versus external. So you may see that you caused it or that something outside of you was the causal factor. There's stability and instability. So is this something that is kind of a consistent pattern? It always happens, or is it not so stable? And then is it global or specific? Do you see it as being very pervasive and huge, or is it one thing, but you know there are many others that also play into whatever the dimension is you're talking about? And it's that third factor, the globality, that we are calling catastrophizing. This tendency to, when things happen, and particularly when bad things happen, to think, oh my goodness, it's a huge big deal, and to really blow it up into something bigger than objectively speaking it is. And that really does seem to be quite harmful. You mentioned being, you know, maybe worrying about things as part of this conscientious dimension. And we, although people who are conscientious may, in fact, worry a bit, we also looked at neuroticism, which is explicitly that. People who are high on neuroticism are anxious, they're rather high strung, they do tend to worry quite a bit. And we saw that that in and of itself, although I don't know anyone who strives to be more neurotic, that it's actually much more complex. It's not an entirely negative thing, particularly for men. Being a bit worrying, a bit more anxious was actually kind of good for them. And especially when they were facing a crisis, if they, you know, had a problem in their lives. We looked at men whose wives died, and they actually, if they were high on neuroticism, they were at a 50% decreased risk for mortality in the subsequent few years. So this worrying and anxiety, at least up to a point, can be beneficial. It may lead you to plan differently, to think out possible outcomes, to, you know, come up with a plan B just in case. But the catastrophizing is really blowing things out of proportion and tends to make you focus on things that have already happened or that you can do nothing about. And I think that sort of worrying, where there's really nothing to be done except obsess, is not likely to be beneficial.
What about the question of education? We know that people who have higher education tend to have higher incomes, so there's that whole dimension of class and wealth that's attached to education. But what about longevity and education, and is that something that is the effect of these class benefits or something that stands on its own?
Yeah, we looked at that, and we did see that having more education was associated with a longer life, but it was a very small effect, not at all along the same dimensions that we saw for some of the personality and other social dimensions. So consistently related, but a very tiny, tiny association. And another sort of interesting thing about education, we looked at the age at which you actually started school. And that was a bit of a surprise, because I think it's pretty common for people to feel like, well, you know, if you start earlier, you get a head start, you get a jump on things, and that's going to serve you well in the future. And what we actually found is that the kids who started, and certainly these were all smart kids, so mentally they were capable, but those who started school, formal, structured, regular schooling, at age 5 or earlier were at increased mortality risk, you know, decades down the road, whereas those who started on time, age 6 or later, they did just fine.
And why do you think that is?
Well, we don't have the data to be able to answer that precisely, but looking at work that others have done, there are a couple things that we think may be going on. One may have to do with this sort of, at least a potentially hyper-competitive environment. If you're coming in, you're the youngest kid, you're probably the smallest kid, you might have a lot of pressure to be proving yourself and defending yourself and sort of measuring up in those very early years. Another thing that we know is very important for the brain development of young children is unstructured playtime, the opportunity to explore and engage the world in a sort of free-flowing way. And so to have that removed may also be part of that detrimental effect. But we looked at kids who started on time but then skipped a grade later on, and so they at some point were younger than most of their peers. And we saw that that was not harmful. It really was the age at starting, not how you ended up, you know, a few years down the road.
You're listening to Against the Grain. We'll return in just a moment.
An earthquake is erupting, but not in Orange Street. A ghost dance is preparing, you got to help us with your feet. If you're not in the mood to dance, step back, grab yourself a seat. This may not be uptown Jamaica, but we promise you a treat. Bust a bummy over with your bogus dance, shuffle me off my feet. Even though I'll keep on running, I'll never get to Orange Street. So I say there's nothing left to say for the man who set the beat. So I leave it up to you out there to get him back on his feet. Bust up on me over with your bogus dance, shuffle me off my feet. Even though I'll keep on running, I'll never get to Orange Street.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, found online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today we're looking at longevity, and my guest is the co-author of a book, The Longevity Project, Surprising Discoveries for Health and Long Life from the Landmark 8-Decade Study. Her name is Leslie Martin, and she's professor of psychology at La Sierra University and research psychologist at UC Riverside. And we're discussing a project that spanned almost 80 years of the lives of a number of Californians, which may shed light on some surprising things that shape why some of us live longer than others. One of the things, Leslie, that I found surprising in the conclusions that you all drew from this study was that the single strongest social predictor of whether someone would die young, rather than these personal characteristics, but the single social predictor that influenced whether someone would die young was whether your parents divorced during childhood.
Yeah, that was the strongest psychosocial predictor by far. And that was interesting. And we get a lot of questions about that because at the time that the study was done and when these kids were experiencing parental divorce, it was pretty rare. It had, I think, much more of a stigma associated with it because it tended not to happen. And so we were sort of faced with this question, would it be the same today? If we did start a longitudinal study now, would we see that same sort of effect? And I believe that we would. I think it might be slightly mitigated, but not much. And the reason I say that is that if you look at contemporary studies that certainly are not following people across their entire lifespans, but are looking at what are outcomes of parental divorce for kids, you see some of the same kinds of things that we saw in the Longevity Project. For example, you see that kids are more likely to abuse substances, and you see some adjustment-related issues in teenage years. You see higher levels or higher rates of promiscuity, especially for girls. So some of these health-harming relevant factors that we see in the Longevity Project also you do see in these contemporary samples. We also know that the experience of parental divorce was associated with one's own likelihood of divorce later on. And so to the extent that pattern is sort of learned or it's maybe accepted in a different sort of way, that then has an additional impact later on. If you experienced a divorce as a kid, if that makes you more likely to then divorce in your own marriage, that risk factor is added on there. And that was part of the explanatory relationship that we saw for these kids, that they were, in fact, more likely to have their own marriages later on end in divorce.
Well, so let's talk about that, because again, the conventional wisdom is that if you want to live a long time, you should get married and I presume stay married. So what did the study show about marriage?
Yeah, so first of all, we did find, as is generally found, that a steady, stable, healthy marriage was good for health, and that's true for both men and women, but it's more true for men. The bulk of that association is being driven by the men in the sample, and that's also true in other studies. We looked at being stably single with the idea that maybe it's the trauma of divorce that's really the problematic thing, and we saw that particularly if you're a woman, but for men too, being stably, steadily single was also pretty good. It was the experience of the divorce that was problematic. But then we saw an interesting sex difference, and that was that men who were divorced could substantially ameliorate their risk by getting remarried following that divorce. And that really wasn't so much the case for women. Women were about as well off if they stayed single following divorce. And that was a surprise. Although, again, thinking about it, knowing what the data actually say, it kind of makes sense. When you think about the social ties and connections that women typically, on average, have, they have more of those. They're stronger connections than men often have. And so for a man, losing his spouse is going to have a bigger impact in terms of his social connectedness. Often the wife is the primary or the only real confidant. Often she is the social organizer and kind of the person who gets things going and brings those contacts to the husband. And so the gap that he experiences is likely to be greater. Women often have, a good girlfriend or more than one with whom they can talk about deep issues, and they have social support networks that they can draw on in times of crisis. And we did see that social connections were incredibly important.
Obviously, the study was initiated in quite a different era, but is there information for people who are coupled but not married? And then also, what about gay couples? Was there no information about them?
Yeah, that's a great question. Termin did an additional set of data collection on a subsample of the study, some of which remains in the data set and some of which he actually destroyed because he felt that it was too sensitive. So we don't have enough data to really address either of those issues, those who are cohabiting but not married or gay or lesbian couples. My guess would be that what we would see would not be too terribly different in terms of the importance of those social ties and connections. I think the question would be, to what extent are contextual factors and additional stresses associated with, people in the environment who don't accept your relationship or who, look down on you in some way, to the extent that that is an added stressor, that could, I think, be bad, but environments differ, and for those who are in generally supportive environments, I would expect that we would see very similar patterns for those kinds of relationships as we saw with the more traditional marriage relationships.
What about the degree to which people are happy within marriage?
That was really interesting. So we looked at, and this was part of the marriage study that Terman did, and so he not only asked his participants a bunch of questions, but he also got their spouses, their partners, to answer things. And we found that the happiness in the marriage of the man was important to his health, and it was also important to his wife's health. The happiness of the woman in the marriage was not predictive of her own health, and it was not predictive of her husband's health. So that I thought was really, really interesting and raises, I think, a whole host of new questions about, what may be going on. Why is it that the man's happiness is important not only to him but to his wife in terms of health? And, how does that factor into other associations that we see with social support networks and those kinds of things?
Do you have any conjecture about why you think that might be the case?
I am guessing that it really is conjecture on my part, but I'm guessing that perhaps a woman being unhappy or less happy in a marriage might have, through her social support networks, other areas of fulfillment such that it wouldn't be so important, and also may do a better job of masking that unhappiness such that it would have a smaller impact on her spouse. Whereas for men, perhaps less masking, so more of an impact. And certainly if his marital relationship is one of the fundamental social connections he has, if there are problems there, that might impact him more heavily.
Do you think that those results would be found today? Because obviously the people who Terman measured were people who were middle-aged and mid-century.
I don't know. This is one of the findings that I feel a little less sure how it would play out in the modern age. I think there certainly are lots of men and women that, despite, you know, living in 2011, are pretty traditional. So I don't think we've lost that. But we would probably see, I think, more variability in the types of relationships that are out there. And to the extent that both men and women might be moving outside of those traditional roles, we might see a diminution of that effect, that it might actually be a bit smaller simply because there are fewer quote-unquote traditionalists in the mix.
One of the things that you flag, you and your co-author Howard Freeman flag in the Longevity Project, is the degree to which men are traditionally masculine or women are traditionally what we would define as feminine, mm-hmm. and the impact that that has on longevity. How, explain that for us.
Yeah, so we coded people using a really interesting method, which was devised by Richard Lippa at Cal State Fullerton, what he calls gender diagnosticity. And the thing that's unique about it is it doesn't just, you know, give you a score, but it gives you a masculinity or femininity score relative to the rest of the group that you're in. So we were able, with each of these Terman participants, to score them as relatively masculine or feminine relative to the rest of the Terman participants, which is nice because it adjusts for changes in social norms that happen with time or in geographic areas, perhaps. And so we had these masculinity femininity scores that were calculated based on what people said they would like to do or were interested in doing or thought they might be good at in terms of careers and ways that they would like to spend their time. With those scores, we then looked at, okay, what does that say about someone's longevity? And we found that masculinity was a risk factor. And so the more masculine men were likely to live shorter lives. But that was also true of the more masculine women. And the flip side is that femininity was protective for both men and women. So the more feminine men were also experiencing this benefit. And so this helps us, I think, to say something about the gender gap that we always see, that women on average live longer than men. And that's because on average they are more feminine. So what are they doing? You know, what is it that explains the relationship? And we can't explain it entirely. And certainly there were some behavioral things going on. You know, the more feminine men and women were less likely to be smokers and some of that stuff. But again, it really came back in large degree to those social ties. So the more feminine individuals had more connections with others, were more integrated, I guess you could say, with their communities, with their families. And that's a substantial piece of what's going on. It's not the entirety of it. Some of it is more behavioral. You know, what kinds of risks do you take? Masculine men were more likely to be doing very active, potentially risky things, as were the women. But a big piece does seem to be, again, back to those social ties.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, found online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly, and my guest is Leslie Martin. She's professor of psychology at La Sierra University and research psychologist at UC Riverside. She's the co-author with Howard S. Freeman of the Hudson Street Press book, The Longevity Project, Surprising Discoveries for Health and Long Life from the Landmark 8-Decade Study. So I want to ask you about, again, another trope of what makes people die young, which is stress and working long hours. What did the longevity project indicate about people working hard and long?
Yeah, that idea that you'll work yourself into an early grave and you really need to slow down for your health, that's not true. We found that the people who worked the hardest were tending to be those who lived the longest. They often did work long hours, stayed in their jobs past retirement age, and oftentimes these were fairly high-pressure jobs. You know, they had a lot of responsibility. I will say that these individuals also tended to be successful in their jobs because they did work hard, and they felt that they were doing something important. They gained meaning from their work, and they generally liked what they did. Nobody likes their job every day, but they generally were doing something that they felt committed to and were passionate about. So I think that, you know, if you're working long hours in a job that you absolutely detest, that's probably not going to be so good for you. But if it's something that generally is meaningful for you and you do draw some sense of fulfillment from, it's probably really going to help you rather than hurt you. The other thing that we can see, particularly this is more from other studies than our own, but stress that's associated with interpersonal relationships oftentimes seems to be the most problematic part. So if you could envision a job where, you know, your boss really seems to have it in for you, or you don't get along with your coworkers at all, and so you experience that stress from day to day, that too is not likely to be beneficial. But if the stress is associated with demands of the job itself, and then, you know, you do have the opportunity to meet those challenges and experience the feeling of satisfaction and accomplishment that comes with doing that, that seems to be a really good thing for people.
I was struck by the numbers about, first, the difference between different professions that would be defined as upper middle class professions, scientists and businessmen, and then actually how scientists on the whole tend to outlive, you know, the rest of the population. But it also sounds like different kinds of work may have an impact on longevity as well.
Yeah, and some of that comes back to behaviors too. The scientists oftentimes were in quite stable and steady, maybe stressful, but steady jobs. And in some of the other occupations, you would see less stability, more moving around, and stress that perhaps was less controllable. We also saw for some of the occupations that you might find yourself in social situations more frequently where there is a lot of drinking, or where you've got uneven sleep hours and things like that. And so I think that's another way that certain types of jobs that have demands, maybe not demands, but where it might be a good idea that you're out socializing and you're drinking and you're staying up late, or, you know, you're running here and there, that could be detrimental.
Well, what about exercise? That's what we hear is a crucial thing for, obviously, for health, but also for longevity. If you exercise, you'll live longer.
Yeah, well, certainly, I mean, exercise is good for you. We know that, and the Longevity Project is not arguing that people shouldn't exercise. If you love exercising, if you enjoy jogging or whatever it is, do it. But what we did see is that more than exactly what you were doing, what was important was that you were doing something. And we also saw that when people were doing things that they enjoy, they were much more likely to be consistent in that behavior. And consistency was really what mattered. So if individuals were active in early life and then maintained that over their lifespan, that was really good for them. If they were active, you know, maybe they played college sports and did stuff early in life and then sort of tapered off and became sedentary, it wasn't as if they had banked up all of this activity that served them well. They really looked just like those who were sedentary, you know, from the beginning. But by the same token, those who took up more physically active hobbies and endeavors in midlife and then persisted in those, they looked really healthy. I mean, that was a good thing. So I guess one message there is it's never too late to start. And the second message is I think people get too caught up in thinking that they need to do a very specific set of exercises or log a certain number of miles per week or something. And if that's your attitude and you don't enjoy it, you're not likely to continue doing it. You'll be bored or you'll be frustrated and you'll stop. And so better to pick gardening or walking or swimming or whatever it is that you actually enjoy, and then do that. And that's going to serve you well.
What about thinness? There seems to be a fair amount of research over the past years that restricted calories may be associated with long life, at least in rats.
Yeah, we don't have data in our data set to really be able to look at that. We calculate body mass index, but it is on self-reported weight and height. And, of course, we know that people tend to over-report height and under-report weight a bit. We do not have a wide range of BMI in our sample. So the sample as a whole tended to be pretty healthy. We didn't have a lot of obese individuals, virtually none. In fact, I wouldn't say none, but very, very few. Part of that, I think, is a function of the time. These folks were not eating a lot of fast food, a lot of prepackaged or pre-prepared kinds of things. So although we don't know a lot about their specific dietary habits, we do know that on average they were tending to eat more, you know, home-prepared types of foods, and that at least based on their own self-reports, they were within the normal range for the most part, very few obese individuals.
Well, I want to end by asking you what prescriptions, if any, can be drawn from this 8-decade-long study. What kinds of things can individuals do, particularly if they do not fit the profile in childhood that you describe in the Longevity Project?
Yeah, that's a great question. And we did want this to be practical to people. I mean, it's not a self-help book, but it is a book that we envision people being able to actually use to make improvements, not only to their longevity, but to the quality of their lives. We have in the book a number of self-assessments. In fact, almost every chapter has one to help people get a better idea of where they fall. And I think sometimes people will not be surprised at all by what their scores are. And other times, I think the assessments may provide some additional insight into their own lives. And then I guess if I had one take-home message, it's that we don't need a big list of things. So there, and in each chapter, we offer some guidance, things that we know from our own work and that of others tends to work well in order to help people get on a more healthy path if they feel that they're maybe not quite where they would like to be. Some of that stuff is relatively simple. The social connections were really important. So it's fairly easy, all things considered, to say, look, I'm going to set out a half hour and make sure that I call this family member each week. Or, you know, I'm going to volunteer a few hours each month at this facility and meet like-minded people and make friends and do something good for others, which we also saw was actually important. Some of the other things, changing personality, that's not so easy, but it's not impossible. So, you know, taking small steps and associating with people who have the qualities that you aspire to over time can make a real difference. So I think there are a lot of little things, but the idea of having a list that you really got to stick to, I think the Longevity Project shows we can throw that idea out the window.
How about parents? What advice would you give them based on the findings of the study?
There are a number of things that are relevant to parents. If kids are a little more on the sober or serious side, that oftentimes worries parents. They want their kid to be, you know, laughing and happy all the time. And our study shows that, in fact, the little bit more serious kids actually did quite well. We see that sociability itself, although social ties are important, but being a sort of social butterfly is not harmful, but it's not beneficial either. So I think we can, you know, tell parents to relax a little bit and not worry so much if their kid isn't, you know, the most popular kid in the class or always interacting with others. I think the messages about how hard to push kids and how early to start them in school are probably useful. I think, you know, it's not that every child in the Longevity Project did poorly if they started early, but it's a caution. If a kid is gung-ho and dying to go to school, maybe that's a good idea for that child. But if the child seems happy at home or in a less structured environment, you're not going to do them any harm by letting them experience that for another year or two. So I think things like that maybe can help parents relax a little bit and feel like there are a number of healthy pathways that they can set their children on, and it's not all about getting the exact right answer, but putting together a generally healthy constellation that matters.
What about prescriptions for society? Are there social conclusions, policy conclusions that one could draw from the information gleaned from this study?
Yeah, we actually have a section toward the end of the book on this topic, and we are hopeful. We don't think that this book will change things right away, but we're hopeful it will start the discussion. There are many things for which modern medical technology and drugs are absolutely appropriate in times when you wouldn't want anything else. But we also recognize and we hope that the book will help to highlight the fact that there are a lot of other ways that health and longevity can be improved, and quality of life as well, that don't involve the high-tech fixes, that really focus more on aspects of everyday life and things that people can do for themselves and without, you know, these big interventions. And I think that's important both as we think about how we might save money in our healthcare system and make the outcomes more in line with what I think we would all ideally want for ourselves and for our kids.
Are there specific examples that you could point to that aren't simply about having individuals take on responsibility to change their lives? Are there things that you think societally could help implement aspects of what you've been discussing here?
Well, I think that a lot of times we look at short-term studies as we're trying to make policy, and we look at associations between variables that may exist, but when you place them in a more complex environment, and humans live in a complex environment, they maybe don't play out the way you would have expected based on the more simple type of study design. And we certainly found evidence of that in the longevity project. Some of the things that we expected to see, we didn't see because we were looking within a lifespan context. So I think, you know, encouraging people to do what they can in their own lives and to think more broadly than how can I be fixed. I guess it might almost be thought of as a more preventive and setting myself on a healthy path type of approach, as opposed to how can I fix what's wrong, something that's more biopsychosocial as opposed to purely biomedical and more mechanistic.
So you mean not popping lots of pills and that sort of thing?
Right. And less, you know, in some cases, a pill is exactly what you want. But oftentimes, there may be better, cheaper, and more effective ways of achieving an outcome that doesn't involve a pill or a particular regimen at all.
Leslie Martin, thank you so much.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Leslie Martin is the co-author with Howard S. Friedman of The Longevity Project, Surprising Discoveries for Health and Long Life from the Landmark 8-Decade Study. That's published by Hudson Street Press. She's professor of psychology at La Sierra University and research psychologist at UC Riverside. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thank you so much for listening. And please tune in again next time.
Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Our intern is Ian Scullion. Our engineer is Wesley Burton. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.